I'm going to begin today just having you respond to this. One of the advantages of the fact that the early church was persecuted was you had apologists. And apology in the early church didn't mean like we tend to mean the word apology. You know, it's a person that walks around apologizing all the time. But apologies were the people in the church who were articulated the teaching and the practice of the church to the pagan world in order to really straighten out misunderstandings in the Roman Empire. One of the misunderstandings was about the worship life of the early church. You were not allowed to the Eucharist unless you were baptized in the early church, and because of this what was called the dismissal of the non-baptized, nobody who was not baptized ever knew what went on in the Eucharist or tended not, and therefore naturally stories started to spread. And the word got out something about body and blood, so there were all kinds of accusations about the early Christians that they were practicing cannibalism, drinking the blood of children, and these things spread around, and it really increased the persecution of the early church. And therefore, it was important for the early Christians to articulate what they did do, because they said, if we're going to get in trouble, let's get in trouble for what we are, rather than what they think we are. So this, one of the apologists was called Justin, and this was written in the year 150. And he just simply stated to the pagan world what we do when we get together for worship. And we're lucky this happened, because if this had not happened, we wouldn't know what they did. And so this was his explanation, and I'll just read it. On the day called after the sun, and what day is that? Of course, Sunday. All gather for communal celebration. The memoirs of the apostles are read as long as time permits. Very likely by as long as time permits, Sunday was a working day, so the service had to end so people could get to work. So very likely it was very, very early in the morning. Then the one presiding admonishes his hearers to practice these beautiful teachings. If you sat in my early Christian baptism classes, a reminder that they tended to talk more about how we live in this world and less about doctrines. Here is to practice these beautiful teachings. We say prayers in common for ourselves, for the newly baptized, and for all others throughout the world. Then bread and wine are brought to him who presides over the community. He gives praise and glory to God in the name of the Son and the Holy... I'm sorry, he gives praise and glory to the Father in the name of the Son and the Holy Spirit, and gives thanks at length for the gifts we have received from him. The whole crowd standing up cries out in agreement, Amen. And now they had to explain to the pagan world what this word means. Amen is a Hebrew word and means, so may it be. Then the bread and wine, over which the thanks had been offered, are distributed among all those present. The food is known among us as the Eucharist. As you know, the word Eucharist means thanksgiving. The deacon brings a portion to those who are absent. Those who are well-to-do give whatever they will. What is gathered is deposited with the one presiding, who therewith helps orphans and widows. I guess I'd ask first, is this interesting? And what similarities do you see to worship in the year 150 to our worship, or what differences? Maybe. What do you see as similarities and differences? Yeah, go ahead.
I see one of the differences, at least in most of the congregations I am with, is that they don't have the Eucharist every time they meet together on Sunday. Mm-hmm. And that was the central thing, according to that, was the meeting around the meal.
Yeah.
And we've fallen a long distance away from that.
And it's obvious here, at least in the year 150, that every Sunday was a celebration of the Eucharist, of the meal, the bread and wine. Not having Eucharist every Sunday is a rather recent innovation. you know, if you're against innovations, that's one rather recent one. So,
I have a question. Was it a meal or was it a token like we have today?
I think the early, what I understand from reading liturgical history, the earlier you go in the worship life, the closer you get to a common meal of tables, and everybody seated at tables and sharing a meal. There's a tape in the tape from John Howard Yoder about early Christian worship, you know, and you're talking much closer to a banquet table setting than the kind of token meal that we're more accustomed to.
Paul reprimanded them for that? They were abusing it in some way?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Paul was admonishing them not to abuse the Eucharist, and it was obvious in the New Testament there was a context of a meal. You know, not some people were taking three wafers and some only had one.
Something was the wine.
You know, or is the wine some. Let's just mention that passage or what Paul was concerned about there. It's very interesting. I was reading about social customs in the Roman Empire. And when you were invited to a meal of a wealthy home in the Roman Empire, you had different status according to how important you were. And in the same room like this, you'd have the wealthier people having a better meal here, or the more important people, the less important people having a more modest meal, and maybe less important people having a very modest meal, all in the same room. And the danger, or what Paul was really talking about, was this social custom really invading the Eucharist. So some would have a big meal, others less, and the poor weren't getting any food in the meal. And it was a social custom that was invading the church. I don't know if that has ever happened since. I'm being sarcastic. So that passage too is obvious that we were much closer to a meal. Any other differences or similarities?
Oh, it's very similar in the sense that it's centered around the word and the sacrament.
Yeah, you see the progression there. That's the traditional mass or liturgy of the church.
There's a man that's sort of in charge. It's not just a group, mm-hmm. spontaneous kind of thing. The use of the word all men is still mm-hmm. something we use. The gathering of offerings and how those are dispersed.
And you have the progression, the reading of scripture, the sermon, offering of gifts, sharing of gifts, and then the prayer of thanksgiving occurs before the sharing of the food. Then the interesting, probably what's fallen out but is being reestablished by some congregations, is the bringing of the meal to those who are absent. That'd be interesting some Sunday, wouldn't it? To take the Holy Communion to everyone who didn't show up. They stumbled to the door. But for the early church, especially the sick and those who were not able to be there. I know the congregation in San Diego, California, where my father is a visitation pastor, they started this custom of every Sunday lay people bring the bread and wine from the altar to all of the shut-ins. Or no, they every shut-in at least once a month. But instead of the pastor making it a special thing during the week, it's right after the Eucharist, so that those who are sick, shut in, not able to come to church.
How do they accept that? Would they sooner have the pastor than the lay people?
The pastor went around each person and talked it through, and it's being very well accepted by the shut-ins.
My hunch is it's not a substitution for the pastoral visit. That's probably an addition to mm-hmm. what the pastor's already doing.
Yeah.
A lot of them like to see their pastor.
Yeah, and it's...
There's a very active lay visitation program at the church that I work at, and they call it Have Service, Will Travel. And when it started, they took tapes of the worship service to the shut-ins. Mm-hmm. These were lay people that were making the visits. This was above and beyond all of the visits that the part-time visitation pastor does. And there is no Eucharist involved in that, but the taping of the service went over real well until the people got... Now, this was started approximately 10 years ago, and these same shut-ins are now 10 years older and are very bored with the worship service as such. They would rather have something as a prepared tape instead. But it is a very active lay ministry going out to the shut-ins. What it does not contain, however, is the Eucharist.
Yeah. It's interesting. It's bringing the word by cassette tape. The early church, it was an extension of also the bread and wine. Do you have a sense of this being boring, or do you have a sense of being rather exciting? I'm just reading it. I guess my feeling in reading this was everybody standing up and shouting amen and everything. This was not a Northern European. No, but go ahead.
It's already pretty well fixed. That tradition has been going on for long enough. He doesn't have to explain what a deacon is.
Mm-hmm.
From the New Testament, we know that they organized just about the first thing they did. We always tend to think of organization as the antithesis of the Spirit's work.
Yeah,
they put it together, and still it sounds like it's very lively.
Mm-hmm. And you have a sense of both order and just a lot of life going on. Well, what I'd like to do now is move from this and kind of go through what might be the problem we've had in the last years as far as our worship life is concerned, and then present to you a theology of worship and a tradition of worship, and then from that talk, especially tomorrow, about what meaning and what can this have for our congregation. So that'll be our... Now, part of the problem, or the need for reform, I think you can see it in the way that most of our church buildings were built. And there was a lot of church building that went on in the 50s. And what I have here is a very typical Lutheran church building that was built in the 50s, or after the war. Does it look familiar? you have two sets of pews, all facing the same way. It's very directional. And then you have a division here between chancel and where the people sit. And more often, I think in Lutheran churches, the choir was up in the balcony. This would be more Anglican or Methodist, which really copied the Anglican. But a lot of this shape of the church really came out of a movement in the Episcopal Anglican tradition. Then you'd have the altar table way up against the wall, as far away as possible, and have a lot of space between the altar table. And then the pastor would, in leading the liturgy, has his back to the congregation. And several things that are happening here as far as problems. One, the fact that it seems staged communicates that the pastor is really the performer. And the fact that we're all looking the same direction towards that emphasizes the fact that we're here really to watch something that's happening up here. The direction, the entire mood of it being directional with the altar against the wall, if the altar is a symbol of the presence of God, basically we have a theology here of a God who is out there. Then with the pastor at the altar, with his or her back to the people, then it's communicated, here's the person that's closer to the God who is out there. And then, especially if you have the choir up here, it's performance-oriented. The way the pews are structured, it just teaches you to feel formal when you come in, just the way we sit down. The fact that you only see the backs of heads discourages any sense of family or any sense of community. And I think all of these visual things and the way just we've set up our worship rooms really influence what we think about worship. And all of these, the reason that churches were built like this, it just somehow was handed down that this is churchy. And it had a mood of churchiness. I don't know. What do you think? Is this fairly accurate?
Yes.
And
you know, you talk about the 50s and being, you know, traditionally Lutheran, but just, and I have not been to Europe, but just pictures I see of even of the cathedrals in Europe, there's basically an altar that's very separate, a preaching station, be that a high pulpit or whatever, and the people out there very far away. So obviously that tradition has come from many hundreds of years ago.
And it came from many factors. It mostly is medieval. And we were taught that, I think, or not maybe verbally, but the feeling was that the medieval church was really the most churchy church. This, in the Anglican tradition, it was called the Oxford Movement. They really said this was a prime of the worship life of the church, was the medieval church. And that's where you had this resurgence of building Gothic long vaults. And it came from a lot of medieval practices. One was the emphasis on the grand processionals. You know, and they are wonderful for processionals. If you have a church in the round, you always have trouble what to do with the procession. Is that true at St. Andrew's?
We don't worry about that.
And then you start to realize that the New Testament, Jesus never called us to great processions, so maybe they aren't the most important. Yeah, but they're great for parades. You know, and it's also very British, because if anybody loves parades, it's the British. And a lot of this influence came from England.
Yeah. I would add to that that the movement in the 50s was to make the pews and the acoustics in the place very softened, so that the emphasis became more and more on talking, because the acoustics that are in a lot of the churches that were built in the 50s, you can't hear music beyond the front step leading to the choir chamber. But you can hear the pastor, because he's got a microphone, or she's got a microphone in front of her. And that has developed a big problem when there's been a return to more active musical participation by the entire congregation. Mm-hmm. It's just impossible to have congregations without major remodeling.
Yeah, no, we built a church in the late 40s, I remember as a kid, and it was a, you know, grade A frame. And the entire ceiling was acoustical material, you know, you could hear the words through the microphone, but the singing was just dead. And a lot of the other thing from medieval times, the emphasis was on mood. You know, the emphasis of a church building, and this was a goal of a church architect in those days, to create a space that would have a spiritual or religious mood to it. You know, I think it's important that in liturgical church building today that you don't say, well, let's try to have it an unspiritual mood. But that was really the goal.
But I think it's also important to point out that the mood that the medieval church was trying to produce was not that what we think it was. I mean, we have a tendency to think of it as being very passive, very quiet, whereas it was, I mean, what you're talking about is an example of us taking what we think the medieval was trying to do and reproduce it in this way without getting a hold of some of the whole other aspect of it, because there was a great deal of activity and noise, and the pews were in the church in those days. And there were performances that were done in the middle of the church, and there was drama that was done in the middle of the church, and there was the parade was not just a stage thing going down the center, but it could have been a carnival out there with clowns and everything.
Yeah, I think it's more our perception, isn't it?
So we have a perception of these big somber churches which everybody walked around whispering, but in fact there was a lot of dancing and yelling and laughter and singing and things like that that went on in this church.
I think this at its best was at the Pacific Northwest Synod Convention in Spokane, and the great Eucharist of the convention was in the Cathedral of St. John. You know, gorgeous, majestic Gothic cathedral, you know, and every pew was filled, and there's so many people there. They're sitting in the aisles and their transepts up around the altar, you know, and there was a great parade, you know, and a festive spirit. That building, were you there? Sure. So you know what it. Well, and I think it leads what I want to mention now, that we've brought into this a lot of other things from our past, and I'm going to try to show, and maybe you can add some. First of all, from this comes a certain attitude of worship that tends to be very Protestant, I think, and that is this attitude that your main reason for a person to go to worship on Sunday morning is to get something out of it to help you through the week. Does that ring a bell? You know, that somehow if you don't have something to take with you to make it through the week, then somehow that worship experience has failed. So then that puts the pressure on the pastor, you know, that something has to be given. And so it becomes very much kind of a consumer mentality. And this is just kind of goofy, but it's called How to Kill the Liturgy, and I just made up a conversation, you know. Reverend Smock's sermon didn't do much for me today. Actually, I don't think he was that bad today. I even stayed awake, and ha ha. I just imagine lay people say things like this sometimes. Do they? Or am I just paranoid?
Of course we see it.
There's no ha ha in the end.
And what did you think of the choir? Well, the choir inspired me today. It helps when Gertrude Olsen is out of town. in the choir, the choir really fits into this of, you know, you receive a certain inspiration from the choir that kind of is, it's almost like a fuel stop, you know, the fuel for the week. And then see you next Sunday. I'll be there. The young assistant is preaching. He's always more interesting than Reverend Smock, right? Because the assistant pastor always reaches the youth. Well, does this ring a bell? In the 60s, when there were so many changes going on, and we were influenced by Vatican II and all the changes in the Roman Catholic Church, and it was the coming of folk music and the youth culture, and there was a tremendous nervousness in the church in the 60s. You know, what are we going to do about the liturgy? Do you remember that? And so this is what we did. We had a decade of change. That's when we started changing the thous to the yous, remember? And then we started to think, if only we can bring in some things, that's going to help worship. So we did everything from balloons to guitars. But then this caused a lot of trouble with more conservative people, so many congregations then, they divided the congregation between the contemporary people and the traditional people. And then you had a contemporary worship service that would have balloons and guitars, and then you would have the traditional worship service that would have...
At 11 o'clock.
You know, and the traditional people always got the traditional time, and the contemporary people who liked to sleep in got 8 o'clock. I don't know. I always wonder why that happened. But was this a reality in a lot of your churches that you had the two?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's not a was. It is.
Oh, it still is.
The one that still is.
Mm-hmm. Or you have a contemporary service and a traditional. What one thing I want to show today in working through a theology of worship is how we've misused the word tradition or traditional. So what we tried to do then was really to, it was an attempt, and it still is, an attempt to kind of make, and it still goes back to the basic understanding that the reason I worship on Sunday is to take something with me, a consumer mentality. So this isn't, I don't think it's all bad to have two worship services with different ways. But it also does fit into this that we keep everybody happy or we meet expectations. People have different expectations. And I don't think there's an easy solution to this, and I appreciate the tension the worship committee has, that you have all of these different responses or expectations. We had the chairman or chairperson of our worship committee in Albuquerque was... he tended to be traditional, but he liked the... I'm using traditional now with a small c. I'll explain that later. But he liked the contemporary too. But the most traditional thing to him was reading the Christmas story from the King James. You know, and if we didn't read the Christmas story from the King James, it spoiled his Christmas. So we made a deal with him, and it really worked well. He said, I'll support every liturgical innovation during the entire year if we read the Christmas story from the King James. So we made this deal, and he did. He supported any change, you know, and then Christmas comes, and we even scotch taped the King James into the RSV pulpit Bible. When I left, that's the last thing I looked at. I just opened that up and I said, I have to see that one more time. But is this a reality that we're working with all the time on our worship? Yeah, and that's why I really have these questions. What is contemporary and maybe traditional isn't traditional? I go on with just some other ways that we've tried to make worship alive. And some of these are a little funny. Some congregations do it by what's called liturgical archaeology. And that means you find out how it was done in about 1400, and then you do it that way. You know, it's probably more our perception, because then the important things are stained glass windows, the pastors having the right robes, the right names for everything, and the right motions. And in seminary, we were rather mean to some people. We called them chancel prancers. Did you ever hear that? And then there'd be this division in seminary between the low church and the high church. And then they would actually fight, you know, and argue with each other. And the low church people were more into preaching, and the high church people were more into liturgy. And you even thought of yourself as either a liturgist or a preacher. And if you were a liturgist, the important thing was wearing the right clothes and holding your hands in the right way and doing everything properly and lighting the candles in the correct way. Then the low church was everything then was centered on the sermon. But I'm uncomfortable using low church and high church because there are more Anglican words than there are Lutheran for us, but we use them and we know what they mean. You know, a high church is somebody that likes to do a lot of correct things, and a low church is somebody that doesn't. Right? Do you want to write that down? But the opposite of this, the whole emphasis of the service was on the sermon. And when you called a pastor, you tried to call a pulpit giant. And then the liturgy, first of all, you cut out the Eucharist, except for four times a year or once a month. And then it became kind of tacked on at the end because the service was the sermon. And then you knew this even by the theatrics of it, because the lights always go down during the sermon and the spotlight on the preacher as he or she, mostly he, mounts his pulpit. You know, and I remember the second church I served in, St. Charles, you know, the feeling it was of walking up that pulpit and then the rheostats going down and then the spotlight coming up as I opened my notes. You know, you're just really ready. But then there's a sense that here it is, this is it. Okay, then the other things that happened, no matter what of these two styles you followed, it was equally important that you got the candles lit properly. It seems to have nothing to do with high church or low church. And then the main thing about going to church is seeing if the two acolytes finish at the same time. And then gasping with embarrassment as one candle won't light. And then at the end of the service, you have a great ceremony of putting the candles out. That's one thing I've observed. Okay, the other thing that came into our American worship tradition was the extreme importance of sentimentality. This probably came from a certain 19th century frontier religion where it was very important to build up into a very religious mood. And this was done both by conservative and liberal churches. you know, more conservative, revivalistic churches would build this more up by an emotional sermon that would build up the emotional pitch. And a more liberal church would do this more by the theatrics of the type of music and the lights going low or the lights coming up and just the whole mood of the service. But it was to develop a certain emotional pitch. And this was my organist in my little congregation in California that we, she loved the vibrato on the Hammond organ. And on once the vibrato broke, and we had a 3-year battle of my forgetting to have it fixed. And then added on to that was then in the 60s came in the additional thing of you can really build up a good mood if you get folk music and guitars and drums and balloons. And that's also when banners came in. And finally, you know, many times you'd go into church and you'd be drowning in banners. Remember that? Now, I'm not knocking these things, like the joy of banners. I mean, I've led a lot of banner workshops, you know. But the problem with a lot of these things is a problem of our whole Christian life in a way. Somehow we think the solution lies some other place than a basic change of heart or repentance or metanoia. That we thought that somehow we could revive our worship life with either the right preaching or the right guitars or the right colors or the right lighting system. That somehow we thought it was there. And I think we're moving now into a more mature understanding that the revival of our worship life, the renewal of our worship life really comes from a spiritual revival of our hearts. And I want to I'm really going to go in two directions now. One, to look at the word tradition, and the other, to start looking at the depth of the meaning of the word ritual. So I want to start with tradition and ask this question. Is there an apostolic tradition in worship that is basically has been understood since early times as unchangeable? And I'm going to come out saying yes. I'm going to come out very much a traditionalist. And by tradition, I mean there is a given of the way we worship that goes back to apostolic times. And any time we change that tradition, we are really choosing to step out of the form of worship that some liturgical scholars say that Jesus, in a way, might have even given to the apostles. And we've never had problems with this with doctrine, that somehow the doctrine of the church is a tradition that's handed down from the apostolic age. You know, in fact, we seek to have a doctrine of our church that's in harmony with the New Testament and with the apostles. Now, it's a harder question with social ethics. You know, is there a bridge between the New Testament and social ethics in our world today? And I think one of the strengths that has been Holden Village is that it's been at least much of the teaching here at Holden Village has been a call to the church to connect social ethics with the apostolic witness. And if you want, I don't want to get off into this, but if you want a prime example, I think, of a disconnection between social ethics and New Testament tradition, read the proposed LCA social statement on peace and politics. You know, and it's expected because the mainline churches have really tended to go more towards the philosophers of this world for their social ethics rather than to the scripture. Okay, but that could be a whole other form. You want to do that next week? I won't be here. Okay, then seldom is this question asked about worship. And it's really a Roman Catholic liturgical scholar, John Gallen. Have any of you met John Gallen? If you are ever in charge of a big professional leaders conference and have to get a speaker, try to find John Gallen. to come. He is a Roman Catholic Jesuit liturgical scholar that makes worship live. You brought up the meal. You know, he has a lifetime commitment, I think, to restore the sacraments to be real things that real people do. Like, he calls baptism the bath of the church. Well, that isn't really a liturgical sounding word, is it? The bath of the church. He really confronted us with this of connecting liturgical practice to a tradition that he says goes back to the apostles and to the New Testament. Now, just a little further definition of where many of our practices have come from, and then and I think we need to know these so in some ways we can get through these to really ask the question of what is the tradition. One, we've already talked about, a lot of our worship form and practice comes from medieval forms. Then many others come from Protestant reactions to what Protestants felt was too Catholic. You know, a lot of what we do in a Lutheran worship service, the main reason is that we can't do anything else because that would be Catholic. Have you ever heard that? I think one of the major Protestant reactions is the infrequency. Is that all okay?
Did you already flip it?
Yeah.
Okay.
It is flipped. Where was I? The infrequency of Holy Communion, probably one of the major Protestant reactions to what was the overemphasis of the Roman Catholic Church on the Mass over against the preaching. So some of what we have are Protestant reactions. You know, at least in the American church, very Lutheran Reformation custom of making the sign of the cross, you know, has really went out because of this reaction. European custom of having a crucifixion in the Lutheran church, you know, is another example of something that's been taken out in America because of a reaction to Catholicism. The other thing that has informed a lot of what we do is what we might call 19th century American piety, which a lot of when people say, let's sing the good old hymns, they're talking about the hymns of the 19th century American piety. Then every congregation has its patterns of worship that kind of become our patterns. The first congregation I served in Illinois, and this always frustrated me when we moved west, because the definition of the church in the west is where nobody comes to Lenten services. You know, and in Illinois we pack them in. There is standing room only for Lenten. If you serve in the west, you know what I'm talking. Do they still come out at Lent and sing?
Not as much.
West tends to creep east. We packed them in there in Illinois, and the thing that people waited for all year is we, at the end of the service, we turned the lights down except for the neon lights behind this gigantic cross on the wall, and then everyone stood up and everybody got to sing the soul of the Lord's Prayer. You know, and people would be in tears as you reach that high, you know, for thine is, and it was our custom, you know, and if you ever went to that church as a pastor, that is one thing you could never change, you know, because it becomes our, and then you see how then these things become tacked onto the word traditional. And then we've added contemporary innovations that we've added onto all of this. So what I'm asking now is, can we kind of get, not that we would throw all of this out because every age has something to contribute, but can we somehow weave through this and get back to a tradition, and then can we bring that tradition to our contemporary age and make the tradition contemporary? Now you're getting a hint how I'm going to start using the two words. John Gallen really helped, and he uses the he uses the word big T and little t. And I have a friend in San Diego, too, who's a liturgical scholar, who uses, instead he uses tradition and convention, but John Gallen uses the big T and the little t. And he says the big T is the tradition that really was handed down by the apostles as this is what Christians do when they gather for their communal worship. And it is this, and then I want to show you how this is very Hebrew in that what it intends to do to us and how it really intends to convert us. You know, and it might even become very close to revivalism, the ritual of the liturgy, the tradition that's handed down from the apostles is meant, each time we go, it means it's a way for us to be converted. And conversions are not boring. Have you ever had a conversion that was boring? And that's when you start getting the key that to make worship alive is not to find the right gimmick, but it is again for us to understand what we mean by ritual and traditional ritual. Okay, the basically the tradition is that when the apostles gathered for worship, they would first gather to tell the story. Just tell the story, and you had the beautiful example of that in our Bible study this morning, just telling the story. And then, as it said, then the homily would be on how do we live these beautiful teachings in our lives. And then there's evidence that always when Christians met, after the telling of the story, they pray for each other, and they pray for the world. They become a priestly people. And then they share the peace with each other. Now, so many people felt when we started shaking hands in church and sharing the peace, it was like a modern innovation. Did anybody in your congregation think, my goodness, this modern innovation, now they're making us stand up and shake hands? And without realizing that probably this tradition goes back to the resurrected Christ meeting the disciples and saying peace, and they kissed each other. And not once then after that did the disciples stop when they met together for the breaking of bread to share what in the New Testament is the kiss of peace. And it always was in the liturgy. It's just when we grew up, it had become, like most things, so formalized. It was the pastor singing, "The Lord be with you." And then everybody. What liturgy was that from that I just said?
I don't know.
It wasn't Norwegian.
No, that was the old Augustine. That's my childhood. Wow. That was the best liturgy ever written, the Swedish Mass. What?
God is in
His Heilig, Heilig, Heilig. But so it was formalized, but what really in liturgical renewal was really the restoration of when the community gathered in the name of Christ, they shared the shalom, or the peace with one another. Okay, then after telling the story, then the community offers the gifts of bread and wine, of food, and then part of that food is taken and it is blessed. Thanksgiving is given, and then the meal is shared. Now, you can see this in the New Testament. There's Eucharistic hints under the stories in the Gospels. Jesus meets the 5,000, and then he takes the bread, he blesses it, and he distributes it. Jesus on the road to Emmaus, first he tells the story, he tells of the scriptures, and their hearts burn within them, and then the disciples stop at Emmaus, and the guest becomes the host. And then the language in the Emmaus story is Eucharistic. The guest who becomes the host breaks the bread. gives thanks and breaks the bread. And then they recognize him as Christ. And then they go and tell everyone about it. Now, so what I want to get at now is what, in a Hebrew understanding now, what is happening here when the community does the ritual, because we've tended to, if we do the rituals, we just do it instead of understanding what ritually is supposed to be happening to us as we do it, and that's why the tradition can become dead. Okay, but what's helpful at this point is to separate what is traditional from what John Gallen calls the little t. And the little t is all of the cultural forms in which we wrap the tradition. This is the language that we use. This is the music that we sing as we do the tradition. This is the art, the visual forms that we use as we do the tradition. The architecture that we surround ourselves with as we do the tradition. These are little t. Or these are the difference between tradition and convention. Now, if you'll think back, think of all the arguments in the church that are really called tradition, but are really convention. And how I think in a congregation and teaching about worship and liturgy is to try to help people to very clearly understand the difference between what we're talking about, tradition, and what we're talking about, convention. I don't know, do you get it? Do you see that? And what convention can change, and it needs to change, and it always does change, and the convention takes on different forms in Africa, and it should, takes on different forms in China, India. This is what you want to have in indigenous forms of convention, and the Pope was really wrong when he went down to Africa and tried to get them to change their convention. And he doesn't understand yet that he was talking about their convention. He wasn't talking about their tradition. If you understand, it was when the Pope went down and tried to stop African churches from using all the drums and the colors and the dances of Africa. You know, and unfortunately, he didn't understand the... And let's not point our finger at him. Do we understand? Okay, then when you look over this way, is it also gives you an agenda for what we need to do in the church as far as working on the liturgy. The conventions are important, and it's one of the marvelous things about the Lutheran Reformation that it took the tradition and really put it in the conventions of the German people. And our problem is we always want to freeze that as being religious, but to them was very contemporary. And contemporary is really meaning using the cultural forms of our time to embody or to wrap the tradition. As you can see, is that when the practice has happened in most of our Lutheran churches to only share the Holy Communion one Sunday a month, there we are in a problem of really deciding or somebody having decided to break a tradition of the Christian Church that was really handed from the apostles. And therefore, that does not become kind of a low priority if a congregation is concerned about worship renewal. You know, and it doesn't mean a little worship committee just jumps into a congregation and says, tomorrow we're going to do it Jesus' way. You know, and then you have everybody up in arms. In Albuquerque, I was in a congregation that was 90 years old. You know, it was a kind of congregation where it was like the Greek Orthodox Church. You thought of change as what would happen in the next century. So the idea of having Eucharist every week just at one of the services, took me 2 years, really just careful pastoral work, counseling, going to women's circles and teaching little classes on worship and the Eucharist. And until there was a real desire of people who really loved Jesus in a way that wanted to share Jesus in the Eucharist every Sunday. I'm sure others of you could share either your frustrations or your joys.
I can remember when we had it twice a year.
Mm-hmm. Twice a year was, or four times was very common in earlier America.
Yes, and then you bow to the altar guild volunteers who prepare the wafers and the wine and all the work that it is for them. So mm-hmm. even if you wanted it, you have to think about your altar guild.
You know, there's
watching all those little cups.
And we know, we now have disposable. That's, it costs, but it's worth it.
Now I've found if congregation wants to do something, you can figure out the logistics. You know, it's like in your family, if you want to do something, you
make it happen.
You figure out how to do it. If you don't want to do something, you
know. I think more difficult than what you were describing is having it dropped on a congregation, and then that pastor leaves. The person who dropped it on the congregation, that pastor then moves on. And when you come in to start work, having to work with those people who are very angry about having it dropped on them, and not only that, the church I work at is a lot more complicated than that. They've changed, did an architectural change to the chancel, and it was dropped on people. And there was none of the preparational education to get them ready for what was going to happen. They just, it has to be done, was what was said, because we're getting new organs. That's the only reason they were doing it.
I wish you would have called me.
I
make house calls.
The staff have now discussed this, and we're brand new staff to the church, and we're really beginning to understand how really deep-seated the problem is, and that we really are going to have to do a lot of backtracking to get acceptance.
If you're planning a major change in the liturgy, it needs, spend 6 months in prayer to just ask the Spirit's guidance, of how, because these are very delicate things, and a lot of it is we live in such a world of change, this was brought out in the book, forgot the name. Never mind.
We can't go from one musical setting to the other with any degree of ease. Yeah. The first time we did it in the Red Hymnal, my goodness, church had never sung the first setting. And then it took two different surveys of the congregation before they would even be willing to learn the first setting. And then fortunately the Green Hymnal came along. And we're stuck in one setting there.
Part of what you're talking about, I think, is a little bit of what Dan was pushing at too, and that's a problem of our time. Tradition is only something which is within the realm of my personal experience. And there's a very little sense of the connectedness to our corporate nature, where we experience things in our life that really have been brought to us and carried on for long periods of time. And I think one way of starting to sensitize people to the fact that every generation doesn't regenerate the world. Yeah. That what we live in is something that has a continuity from a long way back, is to start working in language, to start showing how language is something that is given to us and brought to us. And I didn't invent the English language at about age 18 months so that I could suddenly talk. And that's a good place to begin. Start to press with this, because you said it, the little t is extremely important. It's not ultimately important, but extremely important. It needs to be, I like that 6 months of prayer before you start fiddling around with a little tea conventions. It is definitely something you need to do.
Yeah.
Well, you were pointing out that you add Eucharist more than twice a year, and you have your altar guild to contend with. The church I work at, they just quit. Mm-hmm. They said, if you as a pastor and a church council say that we're going to have it more than this, then you wash them. And then I'm not from Augustana background, but just evolved then that this is why they turned it over, because apparently in Augustana background, the church council was responsible for cleaning up after the Eucharist.
many, many years ago. And they, I couldn't believe it. They all sat there and said, well, yes, that is tradition. Oh, yes, we will wash the dishes. And I was astounded because I wasn't from that tradition. Oh, no.
I'm sure it'll take turns.
I think one reality is that, you know, we're concerned about changes, is that there's no way to make changes without tension.
And
I really have gotten into this in studying the war and peace issue. I've learned more now that I've studied nuclear arms race and the war and peace issue and got involved in that. No, I think